In Paul's first letter to the church at Corinth, in chapter 14, beginning with verse 6, Paul says here, "Brethren, if I come to you speaking with tongues, what shall I profit you unless I speak to you either by revelation, by knowledge, by prophesying, or by teaching? Even things without life, whether flute or harp, when they make a sound, unless they make a distinction in the sounds, how will it be known what is piped or played? For if the trumpet makes an uncertain sound, who will prepare for battle? So likewise you, unless you utter by the tongue words easy to understand, how will it be known what is spoken? For you will be speaking into the air. There are, it may be, so many kinds of languages in the world, and none of them is without significance. Therefore, if I do not know the meaning of the language, I shall be a foreigner to him who speaks, and he who speaks will be a foreigner to me. Even so you, since you are zealous for spiritual gifts, let it be for the edification of the church that you seek to excel." We know, of course, that Paul's purpose in writing this to the church at Corinth is that there were those there who had received miraculous gifts by the laying on of the apostles' hands. They were able to prophesy, to speak in other languages. They were able to discern spirits of evil and so forth. And these were all powers that were given to them. And Paul is now saying, you've got to understand why you have these. They are not for your amusement. And they are not to cause chaos or disorder. In fact, it is in this context where he says, in their assemblies, let all things be done decently and in order. And of course, he doesn't say that there's one prescribed order, that you have a song and a prayer, or a prayer and a song, and that's not what he's talking about. What he's saying is, it is to be done in an orderly fashion, not a chaotic or spasmodic type of action that characterizes some people's worship today. But in our context, he points out here that the trumpet has to make a certain sound in order for us to know what it's telling us. And we can understand this. We're not unfamiliar with this. If a trumpet player starts playing taps, we know that's not to send us into battle. And if he blows the battle sound that says it's time for us to rise up and to go into battle, we know that that's what we're supposed to do. But if he just gets up there and toots around and makes a few sounds, we're going, what's that? Well, it's an uncertain sound, isn't it? It's an uncertain sound. I was thinking about this when I was hearing the concert band tuning up on the stage last Thursday, Dylan's concert band. I thought, now there's an uncertain sound if I ever heard one. Everybody's playing something different. But anyway, we understand, of course, that there's a reason why these instruments make a sound, and it has to be a certain sound, one that is meaningful in order for it to serve its purpose. Now, the gospel message, according to what Paul is saying here, is something that is too vital to be proclaimed with an uncertain sound. We should try, and this is what Paul's pointing out here to these brethren over here in Corinth, we should try to speak in a manner that we leave no doubt about where we stand in the midst of a world filled with confusion. If we make an uncertain sound, people might go, "Well, those are nice words. What did they mean?" And that's what happens a lot of times. People just babble on and on and on. And really, it may sound good. But then when you sort it all out, what is it saying? What did it teach you? What did you learn from it? So we understand the gospel to be too important and too vital for us to allow it to be proclaimed with an uncertain sound. But also, this tells us that we should live to try and leave no doubt about how God expects man to live in society. Our lives are not to present to the world around us an uncertain sound. Now, how could that be? Well, one day they see you acting one way, and the next day they see you acting another way, and they're going, which is it? Which is it? That's an uncertain sound. So these are very important things that teach us that Christians are to avoid making uncertain sounds in a world that needs clear distinction and direction. Now, how can a Christian do that? Well, I think there's a few areas that we relate to here in the time that's allotted to us this morning that might be helpful. I think one of them we've already discussed a little bit here in context of 1 Corinthians 14, and that is language that clearly expresses what the Bible teaches. As Paul pointed out here, if people don't understand what we're saying, we're just speaking into the air. We're just speaking into the air. And there's really no benefit from it. Those who were empowered with tongues in the first century were to respect this principle. And notice it has to do with tongues. Now, some people today in the religious world believe that speaking in tongues is a sign of salvation. And if you don't speak in tongues, then you're not saved. Well, what do they mean by this? Well, what they're referring to is an unknown tongue. Now, this is a case where shallow reading and little understanding leads to great misunderstanding. Okay? An unknown tongue. In other words, nobody knows what it means. And so, if you start babbling off with phrases or sounds and so forth, and say, that's my unknown tongue, who's going to argue with you? Who's going to argue with you? Because it's an unknown tongue. If you knew what I was saying, then it wouldn't be an unknown tongue. Are you getting the picture here? And so it's real easy for people to be deceived into thinking that they can just babble on and on and on in some strange sound and then call that unknown tongues. Well, the first thing that we need to establish here biblically is that tongues are languages that are easy to understand to somebody. Now, they may be unknown to you. I tell you, I get around somebody who's speaking Greek, and they really are speaking Greek, and that's an unknown tongue. I recognize it as Greek because there are certain words that I have become familiar with through the study of the Bible that I hear them say, and I think, oh, I know what that word means, you know, but I can't interpret what they're saying. But you know, if I spoke Greek, I would expect for them to speak in a language in such a way, their language in such a way that I could understand them. Same thing true with any language, right? Spanish. I mean, to many of us, Spanish is Greek. Might as well be Greek, you know? But there are people who speak that language. When Dylan hears someone speaking in Spanish, his mind immediately tunes in and he understands what they're saying. Because he's been taught that way. When people start speaking in Spanish, I start thinking about something else. Because I don't know what they're saying. I have no idea. But it is a language. It is not babbling. It is not just strange sounds. The unknown tongue of the Bible is a language that you don't know. But somebody does. Somebody does. In Acts chapter 2, verses 6 through 8, notice, the sound of the rushing wind had come, and the multitude came together and were confused because, listen to it, everyone heard them speak in his own language. Did they all speak the same language? No. But they heard in their own language, and they were marveled and amazed and said to one another, "Look, are not all these who speak Galileans?" You wouldn't expect this from a bunch of lowly Galileans. "And how is it that we hear each in our own language in which we were born?" Now that's the tongues of the Bible. Understandable languages. And tongues, or the speaking in tongues as a miraculous gift, were to be publicly used only when there was interpretation. That's what Paul's pointing out here. If I babble on in some language that you don't understand, what are you going to get out of that? What are you going to get out of that? Well, at best, maybe annoyed. But you're not going to get anything good out of it. In Acts chapter 2 and verse 5, you remember, there were dwelling in Jerusalem Jews, devout men from every nation under heaven. And whenever Peter told them that what they saw and what they heard was something that they could understand, well, it was a language they could understand. It was not noise. But in Acts chapter 2 and verse 27 and 28, the Apostle Peter says, "You will not," talking about Jesus here now, "you will not leave my soul in Hades or allow your Holy One to see corruption, for you have made known to me the ways of life, and you will make me full joy in your presence." And I see that's not the passage that I intended to put there. And I can recognize it right away. In 1 Corinthians chapter 14, the Apostle Paul, that's what I wanted to put there, and I knew that didn't sound right whenever I popped it up. In 1 Corinthians 14, whenever Paul was giving them direction, he says, "Let him who speaks," this is 1 Corinthians 14, 13, by the way, "let him who speaks in a tongue pray that he may interpret." Why? Because, go back to verse 13, it is for the edification of the church. And what edification do they get if nobody understands what you're saying? That's the point. He says you may be able to bless with the Spirit, but the one who is uninformed can't say amen to it if you're speaking a language they don't know. And of course, Paul says, I thank my God I speak with tongues more than you all. Yet in the church, I would rather speak 5 words with my understanding that I may teach others than 10,000 words in a tongue. And then he goes on to explain to them that tongues are a sign not to those who believe, but to unbelievers. And by the way, in the charismatic movement today, it's just the opposite. To them, tongues are something as a sign to them. It is not used to go out and preach the good news to people who don't understand their own language. In fact is, there's nobody for them to go to. You know why? Because nobody speaks that language. You see? So I think that's very, very clear. I'm sorry for the reference there, but we'll get back on track here. Now, tongues were to cease. Now, that doesn't mean languages were to stop being spoken. That doesn't mean that. It means that once they had served their purpose, there would be no longer the gift, miraculous gift, of speaking in tongues. Look carefully at 1 Corinthians 13. We always think of 1 Corinthians 13 as the love chapter, and indeed it is. But he says here, beginning with verse 8, love never fails. But whether there are prophecies, they will fail. Whether there are tongues, they will cease. Whether there is knowledge, it will vanish away. For we know in part, and we prophesy in part. Now, let's go back and look at that. Whether there are prophecies, they will fail. Now, just a minute. In the Old Testament, it said that if a prophet makes a prophecy and it doesn't come to pass, he's a false prophet. Is that what this is talking about? No. It is the outpouring of God's will, and this is prophesying, is the forthtelling. Not just foretelling, but forthtelling. It's preaching by inspiration. That's what it is. And he said, this will fail. In other words, it's not going to keep being this way. And whether there are tongues, they will cease. Now, tongues means languages. Are they going to stop being languages? Is that what that means? No. No. He's talking about the miraculous gift that allows you to speak in a language in which you are not schooled in order to teach the gospel to someone else. That's what he's talking about. And what does he say? They will cease. And whether there is knowledge, it will vanish away. In other words, at this point in time, everybody's going to be stupid. Is that what that means? No. He's talking about the miraculous gift that gave knowledge to people that was necessary before the written word. But there'll come a time when it's not needed anymore. Now, after saying all this, he says, we know in part, we prophesy in part. In other words, we are receiving God's word miraculously now, and it's coming into its fullness so that we will have the revealed word available to us. We won't need this anymore. We won't need it anymore. But when that which is perfect has come, that which is in part will be done away. Now, what does he mean by this? Well, if you'll just look at the words that are used here in that verse, I think you'll see it in real clear fashion. He says, that which is in part will be done away. As opposed to what? It is the part versus the what? The whole. It is the incomplete versus the complete. That's what he's talking about here. Has no reference to Jesus' second coming, as some of these charismatics would like us to believe. Has nothing to do with that. He's contrasting the part with the whole. And I think it's very clear when he likens it here to being a child. He said, I spoke as a child, understood as a child, I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. How does that fit what he just said? The prophesying, the speaking in tongues, the miraculous ability to know things are just the part. When the whole, or perfect, is come, the part is no longer needed. That's exactly what he's saying. And that is what he means here by putting away childish things. Now, he says, we see in a mirror dimly. Right now, we don't get the big picture. We're just getting what God is revealing to us at this point in time, he says. But he said, whenever that which is complete or perfect has come, he says it will be like looking into a mirror and seeing ourselves face to face. Now I know in part, but then I shall know just as I am known. In other words, I will know completely what God's will is. And now abide faith, hope, and love, these three, and the greatest of these is love. Now, tongues, as they were used in the New Testament time, were not to be here permanently. They were for a immediate purpose, and they serve their purpose. Now, speakers of truth must of necessity, whether it be publicly or privately, must respect this principle of not making an uncertain sound that Paul presents here. And this, of course, would call for the avoidance of language that is hard to understand, or, as we might call it, theological jargon. That's the religious side of psychobabble, okay? Theological jargon. A whole lot of big words that make people, woo, wow, that's really high. I can't get that. That's not what we're talking about. That's uncertain sounds. Some may be impressed with big words. Some may be impressed with concepts that they judge to be so far above them that they can't understand them. But that is an uncertain sound. You don't know whether to be sad or whether to go to battle. Because you don't know what it means. See? It's an uncertain sound. And that's what Paul's trying to point out in our context. Second, those who respect this principle are going to avoid double talk. Double talk is deceptive words. Peter talks about those incidents in 2 Peter 2:3. By covetousness, they'll exploit you with deceptive words, he says. And then Paul to Timothy in 1 Timothy 3 and verse 8. Deacons are to be reverent, not double-tongued. That's what we're talking about here. We are to avoid double talk. Sometimes we phrase this as talking out of both sides of your mouth. It just depends on which side someone's standing on is what they're going to hear. We can't do that. That's uncertain sounds. And those who respect this principle will avoid what is referred to by some as glittering generalities. In other words, wow, that looks good. Look how shiny that is. Look how shiny it is. This is the case, by the way, when religious teachers are caught trying to make prophecies concerning things they say are going to come to pass. And many times in our generation, there are those who take Old Testament prophecies out of context, take a little piece of the book of Revelation, and then they make this prophecy that in a certain number of years or at a certain time, that this and thus and that are going to happen. Why, you know, they twist and turn around that pretty soon. Wow, look at that chart. You can see these online, by the way. Look at that chart. That's impressive. But it isn't true. It isn't true. It is indeed an uncertain sound. But how can we be sure that we are not making an uncertain sound by our lives? Well, we have to live lives that clearly demonstrate what the Bible teaches. I don't think I have to spend a whole lot of time on Matthew chapter 5 with this good audience, because I'm speaking to people who know that a Christian is the salt of the earth, that a Christian is the light of the world. You all know this. But you have got to be this. You have got to let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven, in order to not be making an uncertain sound by your life. Hypocritical or inconsistent behavior in the life of a Christian constitutes an uncertain sound. Jesus spoke to the multitudes and his disciples in Matthew 23. And he said, the scribes and the Pharisees, they sat in Moses' seat. In other words, they are in a position of dealing out the law that Moses gave to you. Okay? Whatever they tell you to observe, that observe and do. But do not do according to their works, for they say and do not. What's the problem? They're making an uncertain sound, aren't they? They say and they do not. Notice down here in verses 25 through 31, Jesus cries out, "Woe to you, scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites! You cleanse the outside of the cup and the dish, and inside they are full of extortion and self-indulgence." Uncertain sound. Uncertain sound. And you know, I don't know how else to put this, but just to put it in real simple terms. We as Christians cannot behave one way when we're amongst Christians and another way whenever we're among our friends in the world. That's hypocrisy. That's hypocrisy. And it absolutely is an uncertain sound. And that, by the way, also applies to us as Christians who behave one way at home and another way when we're away from home. That's an uncertain sound. But also, Christians need to avoid the uncertain sound of negligent behavior. I bring to evidence here Matthew 25:14-30, and I won't read it all to you, but I want to summarize it here. As a man who was going on a journey, and he gave his servants a trust. He gave them various amounts of his wealth to see to it while he was gone. And it came time for him to come home, and he called them to account for it. And we find that those who were wise had put what he gave them to use. And they got interest or usury back on it. But this one fella, he didn't get very much because it's obvious the master didn't trust him a whole lot. This one fella was afraid. He thought, what if I put this to the bank and they lose it? Or I don't get it back. What am I going to do? This man is a hard man to deal with. I'll just bury it out here in the backyard. And when he comes, I'll dig it up and give it back to him just the way it was. The master wasn't very pleased with him. He said, "You wicked and you lazy servant, you knew that I reap where I have not sown and gather where I have not scattered. You ought to have deposited my money with the bankers. At my coming, I would receive back my own with interest." And then he says, "Take away from this man what he has and give it to the man with 10 talents. For everyone who has, more will be given, and he will have an abundance." And listen to verse 30. "Cast away the unprofitable servant into the outer darkness. There will be weeping and gnashing of teeth." Negligent behavior. That's an uncertain sound, is it not? We need to avoid that. In Matthew chapter 25, down at verses 41 through 35, Jesus pictures the judgment scene here. And listen to what he says. To those on the left hand, he says, "Depart from me, you cursed, into the everlasting fire prepared for the devil and his angels." Why? "I was hungry, you didn't give me any food. I was thirsty, you didn't give me drink. I was a stranger, and you did not take me in, and naked, and you did not clothe me, and sick and in prison, and you did not visit me." Negligent behavior. Negligent behavior. In James chapter 1, verses 24 and 25, he talks about the man who observes himself in the mirror and goes away and immediately forgets what kind of man he was. But he who looks into the perfect law, the law of liberty, and continues in it is not a forgetful hearer, but a doer of the work, this one will be blessed in what he does. It's hard to convince people, by the way, that we are Christians whenever they observe us being negligent, even in our public duties that they see us in every day. I can't trust that guy. He'll say he's going to do it, but he doesn't do it. He forgets about it as soon as I tell him. Negligence. But it's also hard to convince people that we are Christians whenever we fail to try and share our faith with them. They must not think much of what they believe because they never talked to me about it. They must not be very convinced, or they would have said something to me. So I guess their religion isn't very important. Think about that. But also there is the danger of marginal behavior. Marginal behavior is the kind that leaves doubt in people's minds. Paul talks about it in 1 Corinthians chapter 8, by the way. He said, if anyone sees you who have knowledge eating in an idol's temple, will not the conscience of him who is weak be emboldened to eat those things offered to idols? You know that there is nothing wrong with eating meat. An idol is nothing. So you don't hesitate to go and so I'll just go over there and I'll have a bite to eat over here. But the one who is weak sees you doing that, and he is emboldened to eat it as unto an idol, which is what he used to do before. And look at verse 11. Because of your knowledge shall the weak brother perish for whom Christ died. But when you thus sin against the brethren and wound the weak conscience, you sin against Christ. Therefore, if food makes my brother stumble, I will never again eat meat, lest I make my brother stumble. That's how convinced Paul was of the importance of this. In Revelation chapter 3 and down at verse 16, this describes marginal behavior. Because you are neither hot nor cold, you are lukewarm, the Lord says, I will vomit you out of my mouth. That's how the Lord feels about marginal behavior. We might refer to this as borderline living. We just get as close to the edge as we possibly can. Do our actions leave doubt about where we stand on biblical subjects? Such as the oneness of the church. There's one body, one spirit, just as you're called and one hope of your calling, one Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father who is above all, in all, and through you, or through all and in all. Do we act like we believe that there is only one church that the Lord is the head of? Or do people think, well, they must think the Lord's ahead of all churches because they never say anything about it. They never say anything about it. Do we leave no doubt about where we stand on such subjects as dressing as women professing godliness? Look at 1 Timothy 2, verses 9 and 10. Let the women adorn themselves in modest apparel with propriety and moderation, not with braided hair or gold or pearls or costly clothing, but, and here's the key right here down in verse 10, but which is proper for women professing godliness with good works. Are we making any uncertain sounds in that regard? Or do we just try to get as close to the world as we possibly can without falling in? We need to think about this. Are you making uncertain sounds whenever you speak concerning the Bible and the things that cause division sometimes amongst brethren? We have to speak out and be known and heard with regard to the truth. We cannot kind of just slip around and not be too sure about what we say and be acceptable to God. It won't work. Uncertain sounds concerning vital issues that often divide congregations are being heard all over the place. Uncertain sounds. I told Laura, I just heard one of those uncertain sounds this week. Congregation in Franklin, Tennessee has a new student preacher. And it's a girl. Yeah. It's a girl. And you can't argue with her either because she believes the Lord called her. So what are you going to do about that? Huh? You don't argue with the Lord calling her. Apparently everybody's there just real happy about that. They've come into the new generation now. Now they got a girl up there preaching. Uncertain sounds. That's what causes this to happen. People have not taught plainly and clearly on what God's Word says in regard to these matters. And because of the uncertain sounds, Satan has made his inroad. And it ain't over yet. If I was a prophet, I'd tell you what's coming next. And it probably won't be that long. Are you making uncertain sounds whenever you talk about biblical truth? Are you making uncertain sounds when you attempt to let your light shine before others? These are thoughts for introspection, are they not? We need to take a look at ourselves. Do the people around me really know what I believe and where I stand? Or am I just making uncertain sounds? I'll leave the lesson with you for your consideration. Hope that you'll find benefit in it, as I know I have. I think there's a great deal in this lesson that we can learn.